This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. How can transgender people get better health care access and treatment? National data show that a quarter of trans people don't get any health care because they fear discrimination. There are more than 500,000 transgender people living in the South, and a new report zeroes in on their experiences. It found that many of them face barriers when it comes to health care access and being treated with dignity and respect. Austin Johnson is principal investigator for the report. He's also a professor of sociology at Kenyon College and joins us now. Austin Johnson, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks so much for having me, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you. I want to dig into this report. It's fascinating, the findings in many ways disturbing, but maybe to talk a little bit about your own experience would really put a fine point on this to help us understand why this is so important. Your personal story, the first time you tried to access health care as a trans man in the South, what happened?
Absolutely. So in 2010, I decided that I would take the next step in my transition and undergo medical transition. And the first step in 2010 was securing a letter from a therapist with a kind of recommendation to healthcare providers to say that I was ready for this process, that I fit the requirements for this process. And getting the letter was really difficult. I had to think through my personal experience, my past experience, and go over that with a therapist. And I had a wonderful therapist who happily wrote the letter and helped me kind of come to terms with the decision I was making. The next step of that process was finding a provider who was willing to treat me, who was willing to provide testosterone for medical transition. I called about, must have been 20 to 25 providers in my area, and I got a similar message from each of them, something like, we don't do that here. We don't do that kind of medicine. And I felt like I had hit a wall. I went through this really difficult process with my therapist. I had come to terms with it myself, and I just kept being told no. So I went back to my therapist. She had worked in healthcare administration in the past, and I said, do you have any tips? Do you have anyone that I should reach out to? She said, let me make a few phone calls, and I'll call you back. So she did, and she said, call this provider. They'll get you in next week. So I thought, great, maybe this person's affirming. Maybe this person will be supportive. I get to the doctor's office, and I remember sitting in the waiting room, and I was feeling all of the anxiety that comes with making the decision to start medical transition. My life was about to change. I was about to change my body. I was about to change the way that my family and friends saw me, the way that maybe my career trajectory was going to go. And I had all of that inside of me. And I thought, maybe this doctor can alleviate that. Maybe this doctor can help me feel better about this decision, or at least feel more secure in that decision. And what I got was the opposite of that. I remember being in the clinical treatment room, and I didn't get the usual bedside manner that I had become used to as a person receiving health care in the South. The how are you doing? What's your life like? What's your medical history? It was very short, all business, limited eye contact. The nurse and the doctor, neither of them really seemed like they wanted to touch me, to check my vitals or to really engage with me on a human level at all. The medication I was prescribed, the doctor said, I'm doing this because I took an oath. There was no compassion for what I was feeling in that moment, which was a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear, a lot of different kinds of feelings. But she gave me the testosterone. And in that moment, I felt I could stand up for myself and say, how are you treating me this way? Or I can swallow that and get the health care that I so desperately needed and wanted. And so I did. She wrote me a prescription for the testosterone with no instructions on how to inject it, no instructions on the type of needles to use to inject it, where to inject it, how I should do that, any preparation to do that. I went home and thought, okay, I'll get this medication filled and I'll figure the rest out. I had a similar issue with pharmacies as I had finding a doctor. The first pharmacy I called said they didn't fill that kind of medication. And so I called around to a few other places and I finally found a pharmacy who would fill it. And so I got home and I was ready and I thought, I have no idea what I'm doing with this. Where do I inject this? Do I need to be careful not to hit a vein? How deep do I need to go? So I got on YouTube and I searched transgender man, testosterone, injection, how to, things like that. And what I found were so many other trans people who were in the exact same position as I was, where their doctors had not given them instructions, had done the minimal amount of care or provided the minimal amount of care and instruction. And people were largely leaning on each other for this kind of instruction. So I learned how to do my shot and from YouTube. And then I made a video and uploaded. I've since taken it down, become a little more private in my life. But I was helping other people at that time, too, of, hey, your doctors aren't telling you how to do this. Here's the proper instruction. Here's how to care for yourself. Here's what to do with the syringes after you've injected. And here's what that should feel like to you. And so I really leaned on trans community at that time to figure out how to best care for myself when my physicians were not caring for me.
And Austin,
and so
it just
that
seemed,
kind of leads me.
Yeah, well, go ahead, because I was going to say that story and your experience captures many of the findings that you and your colleagues report in this latest report. And I wonder if you can give us maybe the summary of some of the findings about trans people trying to get medical care, particularly in the South.
Absolutely. And, you know, that was in 2010 for me. And what I found in 2018 were that trans people across the South were largely experiencing the same things. That physicians in the South, the main standouts for me, are that not just physicians, but providers across the South are experiencing a lack of awareness around what trans means, who trans people are, what their unique experiences are, a lack of education on how to treat them, and a lack of imagination about what is the state of gender in 2019 and how trans people's unique experiences of gender may not match up with their cultural stereotypes of gender, and that trans people's care is compromised. Trans people are mistreated in the doctor's office, even if they get in the door. So many times, trans people, the first step is calling and saying, "Are you willing to treat me?" And all too often, the answer to that is no. And when the answer is yes, we have wonderful providers in the South, some of whom are very qualified to treat trans people, but some of whom may want to treat trans people, but they just don't have the resources. And that stood out to me a lot, is that even when we have providers who are ready and willing to treat transgender people, they just don't have the resources to do so.
And because there are so few or so many who refuse, that means that transgender people, particularly in rural areas, may have to travel many hours to find any kind of competent and careful and humane care.
That's right. We had some of our participants were traveling 2 or 3 hours to places like Atlanta or Asheville to receive care. And a lot of these people who were traveling were not financially in a situation where that was easy for them. And then on top of having to travel to get the care, they were paying out of pocket for that care. So it became an additional burden to be in the South, in a rural area, under-resourced, unemployed, underemployed, underinsured. Our participants showed just what it means to be a trans person in the South in terms of their health care, trying to access care, hitting obstacles along the way. But what we also saw was this beautiful resilience of the trans community, where local leaders and community organizations were taking steps to fill the gaps that the kind of lack of a formal resource infrastructure leaves. And so even in the face of that, we saw a lot of strength in the trans community.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that and get an example of a case just like that in Asheville a little later in our program. I'm going to talk more a little bit more about the findings, too, particularly these judgments that get made on the part of medical offices, and not just the physician. As you say, it's the receptionist and nurses, some of the first people that a trans patient would meet. This is where it starts. How much of this happens on a religious level? Talk a little bit about that and what some of your respondents were telling you.
Yeah, some of our respondents spoke about that and said that they felt that their identities were discounted, or that the aversion that they experienced with their medical provider feeling like maybe they didn't want to touch them or talk to them about their health care, that a lot of that was steeped in kind of the high religiosity of the American South. And that some of our participants were who were under-resourced, couldn't access formal resources, but local organizations like churches were providing resources. But then they couldn't have access to those things because they weren't welcome in those spaces. So in the face of kind of a a widespread socioeconomic disparity in the South. Trans people are even further marginalized because they don't have access to the charities that are there to provide care. Some folks spoke of being denied care outright by their physician on the grounds of religious basis of, we don't treat that, we don't believe in that kind of medicine and those types of things. But more so than that, patients felt that people just really didn't understand their identity, weren't accepting of their identity, whether it was for religious reasons or personal reasons, mostly a lack of understanding and awareness of trans people, that they felt like there was such a gap there that they didn't know how to bridge it.
Often,
if you don't know how to talk to me as a person, how do you talk to me as a patient?
Yeah, this happens with pronouns in particular for
right.
staff that just simply don't want to comply with the wishes of the individual who's standing before them.
Mm-hmm.
And what about,
well,
go ahead, finish that thought because we're running up against a break, but finish that thought and we'll break and come back.
So in terms of the name and pronouns, we saw this happening for participants in primary care, specialty care, and mental health care. And this is one of the easiest things that providers and healthcare practices can change in terms of creating a welcoming environment for their patients. A lot of folks think that they have to invest in expensive continuing education or a wholesale reform of their practice. But that's not really true. Something as small as respecting the name, the pronoun, and the interactions style of trans people can go a long way in terms of creating a welcoming environment so that trans people feel comfortable accessing care, feel comfortable seeking care.
I'm talking to Austin Johnson, a principal investigator for the report of the 2018 Southern Trans Health Focus Group Project, also a professor of sociology at Kenyon College. Just ahead, our conversation continues. We'll bring in a family physician who's been treating transgender patients for over a decade in Western North Carolina. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, continuing our conversation about the barriers that transgender Southerners face accessing health care. A new report from the Campaign for Southern Equality details those barriers and shares recommendations for providers to help them better treat their trans patients. Among them are ways that providers can educate themselves to be more open to trans, non-binary, and gender non-conforming patients. Dr. Jennifer Abbott is a physician who took it upon herself to learn more. She's a family medicine doctor in Western North Carolina Community Health Services in Asheville. She's treated many trans patients and joins us now. Dr. Abbott, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Still with us is Austin Johnson, principal investigator of the new report, also a professor of sociology at Kenyon College. Jennifer Abbott, tell us how you started treating transgender patients at your clinic in Asheville.
Well, I had been a family physician for a few years here at the clinic, and I had one of our therapists and one patient who came to me requesting testosterone therapy for gender transition. And I hadn't had any training in gender-affirming hormones or transgender care. It gave me a little bit of pause, but this patient had no insurance, and I agreed to meet with the patient. He brought me a stack of handouts, which were basically an older version of the World Professional Association for Transgender Health Guidelines and Standard of Care. And after meeting with this very nice patient, I decided to take a leap and go ahead and prescribe some testosterone. And it turned out to be a very good experience for the patient and for me, very rewarding. From that point, I went on to educate myself and learn more. At that time, there weren't a lot of resources available for providers who wanted to learn more.
Well, that I want to learn more about what you have taught yourself and others. But Austin Johnson, let me ask you about something that Jennifer Abbott just said. The patient came in with a handful of pamphlets and folders. That suggests that for trans patients, they already know they better educate their doctor before they walk in the door, right?
Absolutely. We found that in our report, too, that trans folks knew that their providers largely were uneducated. And if they were educated on trans health care, sometimes that education was outdated. And so trans people, by sharing with each other, by going online and searching for these things, kind of like what I did in 2010 on YouTube, of finding the correct treatment protocol And also when you know that providers are largely uneducated and hesitant about treating trans people, it's helpful for trans people to come in with all of the information already there. So saying if a provider says, oh, I don't know how to treat you, our participants and trans people that I've talked to across the South come in ready to say, well, I know how you should treat me. And I come prepared so that you don't have to do that much work provide health care for me.
Dr. Abbott, I get that you realize that patients shouldn't have to go through that. And so you set about training your staff and yourself and doing some retraining about trans-affirming care. How did you set about doing that? Where did you find it, and what does that training look like?
I think one of the biggest resources available is WPATH, World Professional Association for Transgender Health. As I mentioned, that's an international organization, and they have standards of care available online. They also have a symposium every other year where healthcare providers from all over the world can educate themselves and share research. And in the last decade, there have been a lot of strides in research and evidence in terms of the safety of trans-affirming hormones, gender-affirming hormones. There's a wonderful guideline that came out a couple of years ago from the UCSF Center of Excellence in Transgender Health that's available to anyone online. So I think now new providers now who are interested in learning have many, many resources compared to what there were a decade ago. There are also trainings that that are available that people can go to, providers can go to as well.
What have you learned, and how are things different for you? How do you now, what's different in your approach?
I think, as a physician, we always like to see evidence. So it's very helpful to have these guidelines that are available that talk about risks and benefits and studies that have been done, as I said, showing the safety of hormones. I think the most things that I've learned have been from patients and from their experience. So just being willing to listen to a patient, hear what their experience is, hear how they experience their gender identity and what things they're looking for from a healthcare provider. That's really where I've learned the most.
It also seems to me that there might be something in medical training that's absent. The idea that this gender binary is so locked into the training, the biology, which is not borne out in our actual biology. The fact is, it's a much more fluid thing biologically than I think maybe we're taught. Did you find that something that you had to think about, the way in which we understand the human body, and perhaps medical training itself needs to adjust to this?
Yes, I think you're exactly right. There is a movement in medical training to provide trans-affirming, culturally appropriate care for trans patients and for just LGBT patients in general. We're seeing that more and more in medical schools and residency programs. And I think for providers and for physicians who are not themselves trans-identified, it can be difficult to kind of put yourself in the shoes of a transgender patient and understand that experience when you haven't been taught anything about that type of experience. So I think just having an openness and a willingness to, and I think as Austin said, an imagination about gender being more than just the binary that we kind of often grow up with culturally, is just a real important thing.
And Austin Johnson, some of the informants in your report talk about that even among gender-affirming physicians, those who were sympathetic, who see this as kind of an overly medicalized condition, can go too far in that direction, again, because they're working on stereotype. Give us some examples of that.
Absolutely. So we saw this with providers who are treating both non-binary patients, patients who do not identify as either men or women, and patients who identify as men or women. We see that in some cases for non-binary patients and for non-binary participants in our study, that they felt that they were being pressured or expected to adhere to a specific kind of transition regimen. That even when providers were affirming and positive about their identity, they had a specific idea about what that meant and what trans meant, and that their role in helping trans people actualize that gender identity or achieve the kind of outward presentation of that gender. One of our participants, this really stood out to me, was a trans woman who was interested in having breast enhancement. And she was meeting with a surgeon who, in every other case, was very positive, affirming, used the correct name and pronouns, was very supportive of this person. But when it came time to decide on the size of her chest, She mentioned that she felt very pressured by this provider to get a bigger chest than she had originally wanted or was comfortable with. And when she described this to us, she spoke of this as like the doctor wanted to help her become the woman she wanted to be. But in the doctor's mind, what woman meant had very specific connotations, and maybe hyperfemininity. Maybe if you want to become a woman, you want to become, or want to publicly appear as a woman, you want to appear as this very stereotypical idea of what a woman is. One of our non-binary participants mentioned that they had an experience where they had been on testosterone, and then they had decided to move away from testosterone, that it wasn't right for them at that moment. And this happens a lot of non-binary people who experiment with hormones or maybe want to take hormones. Sometimes they go off of them as it depends on what they experience in their gender at that moment or what they feel is right for them in that moment. And one of our participants said that their healthcare provider kind of discounted their identity as trans when they decided to move away from hormones, as if the decision to medically transition or not validated or invalidated their trans identity.
Dr. Abbott, we're also talking about the access to care and the fact that if you have providers in your area that aren't going to see trans people, you have to travel quite a ways to find those who will. You have a clinic in Asheville. Talk about where your patients are coming from.
Yes, our service area for WNC Community Health includes 18 counties. So we go all the way to Cherokee County in the west, and to the east we go as far as Cleveland County. So we have patients coming from all of those areas to seek care. We have around 450 trans patients in our large practice, and many of those come from out of our county, Buncombe, where we're located. One thing that I really try to do is if I get a call from a physician in an outlying community, or an email saying I have this one transgender patient and can I refer them to you for care, most of the time I try to turn that around and say, no, this is your patient. Let me mentor you and let me help you learn how to provide this care for your own patient in their community where they live, which is just so much better all around.
Well, and to that point, I know that you give trainings to other healthcare systems. I wonder what kind of questions you get and to what extent you get pushback when you give these trainings.
Well, often when I'm invited for a training, it is because there is someone in that health system who's a champion, who's interested in making their clinic more trans-affirming. And so that usually sets up a good environment with people who are receptive to learning and participating in the training. Now, you know, when people are required to be in the training and it wasn't initiated by that group of people, then oftentimes there are questions about bathrooms and things like that, which really may or may not be relevant to the training. So we try to, it's really helpful when there is a champion at the health center or at the clinic, and then you can go into that environment with an audience that is really interested in learning and being open.
Whenever the hands go up at a workshop, you can count on the fact that one of them is about the bathrooms, no matter what workshop you're doing.
Exactly. Yeah. And it gets a little bit old.
Yeah, sure, it does.
We have to talk about the bathroom, when really what we care about is health care for all, and that health care is a human right and everybody should be able to receive appropriate health care.
Austin Johnson, what are some of the other recommendations? I mean, you talk about obviously educating and becoming more sensitive and aware. What are some of the other recommendations in your report for physicians like Dr. Abbott who have actually taken the initiative and want to do better?
I would say my primary recommendation is to connect with local trans and non-binary leaders in your communities and talk to them about what the healthcare needs are for trans and non-binary people locally, and try to go to their events and invite them to your events. Connect with each other on providing healthcare to trans and non-binary people where they live to make it easier for trans and non-binary people to seek care. One of the huge things that stood out to me in this report was the beautiful resilience of trans community to create healthcare interventions, maybe like rapid response HIV testing, self-defense clinics, blood pressure monitoring, things like that. But trans people and trans leaders in the South can't provide clinical treatment. So it's important in my opinion, after reading this report and doing the research that I do, for physicians, practices, healthcare systems to connect with those leaders who are doing this work and figure out ways they can work together, support those leaders who are drawing in trans people, who do have the trust of trans people in their local communities, so that those people start seeing physicians as people they can trust too.
And it would be helpful to have a guide to those physicians and other professionals. And joining our conversation now is Kayla Gore. Kayla Gore is an advocate for trans folks and the project advisor for the Southern LGBTQ Health Initiative. She is also one of the people behind the new resource guide released today called Trans in the South. Kayla Gore, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. Tell us about Trans in the South, the resource guide. What is it?
All right, so Trans in the South is a resource guide for people living in the South who don't necessarily have access. I think earlier in the conversation, it was mentioned how scarce resources can be for people in rural areas. So the Trans in the South guide serves a resource that's online and it's also in physical form that people can utilize to find those different resources that are closer to home versus traveling 600 or 700 miles just to see a therapist for 30 minutes to an hour, something that is super important to the transition that we're facing.
Kayla, how do you put this this guide together? How is it informed? And it's not just medical services, right?
So it's healthcare services. The guide itself. Mm-hmm. The heart of the guide is a directory for trans-friendly or trans-competent health service providers. It encompasses 13 southern states. It features over 400 service providers in areas like primary care, HIV care, endocrinology, legal resources, and, of course, mental health service.
Your own experience and your own story, as we began with Austin Johnson telling us his, your story also in accessing healthcare, I think illustrates the point. Would you share it with us?
Sure. So I'll just speak to, like, my present day, because Austin kind of, like, brought us in on, like, a span of maybe 10 or 15 years of how things have advanced. So there's still discrimination against trans and gender nonconforming folks within our community as it relates to accessing affirming healthcare services. And there's a difference between affirming healthcare services and healthcare services. The work that the Southern LGBTQ Health Initiative builds on is the advancements that we have made over a 10 or 15 year span. Whereas 10 years ago, I come into a healthcare facility and people are not savvy to pronouns and what they mean to a person who's transitioning from one gender to the other. Whereas now I lead different trainings with healthcare providers and colleges that are training up healthcare providers before they get into the field to know what pronouns mean and what kind of weight it carries within our community, how to address us, how to provide care for us. So present day, I have the greatest relationship with my doctor. She's almost close to my age, and we have a more of a relationship versus like she's my provider and I'm her client. I can come into her office and I can have some concerns about my transition or that my transition may be stagnant, and she listens to me and she takes what I say and she goes and she does her due diligence and does research to affirm me in that space. Whereas 5 years ago, if I were to come to my primary care physician and say, hey, I want to start hormones, and this is something that actually happened, and my doctor, you know, was kind of reluctant to provide me with those resources. So it basically led me to a dead end where I was utilizing street hormones, which is very dangerous. And a lot of people in the South, specifically trans women of color, we're faced with that. We're having providers to tell us no. And for us, no is not an option when it comes to our transition, because our transition is what makes us thrive and what makes us live our beautiful lives. So we're going to do it by any means necessary, which is why I'm an advocate now, because I don't want people to have to go through that route, because that could have killed me. I experienced blood clots because I was abusing hormones. I wasn't getting those hormones regulated. So I was having blood clots, and I didn't know what they were until I told my doctor, hey, I'm having some discoloration on my leg. And she was like,
those are blood clots. So she did some lab work and she realized that I was taking hormones that she hadn't prescribed. And she explained to me like the dangers of taking hormones off the street versus getting them administered by a healthcare professional and also getting them regulated with regular lab work. So just that kind of like puts it out there where the focus groups that we've held that the LGBT Health Initiative has done throughout the South, it bolsters on people being able to access healthcare in an affirming way, and they're not shunned away and basically put in harm's way.
Are you optimistic? Do you think things are generally changing and getting better?
I do think things are getting better. Like I said, there's still places where there needs to be a lot of improvement. But as far as healthcare providers, we're seeing a lot more healthcare providers come to the forefront as we see that trans people and gender nonconforming folks are being like put in the spotlight more so now than ever. We're having a lot of healthcare providers realize that there's a need and they want to feel that need. So yeah, things are definitely advancing. I don't think they're where they should be today, but we are moving forward and we're not staying stagnant and we're definitely not going backwards.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Kayla Gore is project advisor for the Southern LGBTQ Health Initiative. Dr. Jennifer Abbott is a family physician with Western North Carolina Community Health Services in Asheville. And Austin Johnson is the principal investigator for the report of the 2018 Southern Trans Health Focus Group Project and a professor of sociology at Kenyon College. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Thank you for having us.
You can find links to the report and list of references for healthcare providers at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, before he was a tennis champion, Arthur Ashe was a skinny kid playing now and then in Durham. We'll learn more about his early life and legacy coming up on the State of Things. Stay tuned.